Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology, and today I'm delighted to talk to Robert Carter. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you, sir. Robert is a journalist working for one of Britain's biggest Muslim news websites, Five Pillars, covering current affairs related to Islam and Muslims. He has close to a decade's worth of experience as a fieldwork correspondent, and has reported all over the Muslim world, especially in the Arab world. And right now, his focus is on news of interest to the British Muslim community. And on Twitter, he's pinned a post which says, "Alhamdulillah, as an Englishman, I embraced Islam when I was a teenager, and it was the best decision I ever made." And I like the fact "best decision" is in block capitals. Now, he says, "I'm a Muslim journalist campaigning for Islam everywhere," end quote. Fantastic tweet there. So I guess my first question is, as a revert Muslim journalist, what are the unique challenges that you face compared to, say, your colleagues who are not from that background?
Well, I would say some of the unique challenges. So obviously, being a journalist, we have journalistic obligations and professional responsibilities to, you know, provide information to the general public and to be as truthful and honest as we possibly can. But then also there are obligations that Muslims specifically have. So obviously there are at times where, for example, I may find wrongdoing within the Muslim community itself, and I have an obligation to put it in the public realm. Right. And, you know, some people might be like, well, you shouldn't expose sins. You know, you should give them benefit of the doubt and stuff like that. But, you know, that's how journalism works, I'm afraid. Sometimes we're campaigning for moral causes, which all Muslims can appreciate. But sometimes we find Muslims themselves are actually up to no good. And that has to be spoken about and put in the public realm as well, for the good of our own community, as well as just providing the truth and being honest about things and trying to uproot corruption and things like that. So obviously that puts you in a bit of a dilemma where perhaps, you know, you'll be, certain Muslims will be complaining about our coverage of Five Pillars. But ultimately, I think, you know, there's a reason for it. And, you know, we can't disillusion ourselves that all Muslims are perfect all the time. Islam is a perfect religion, as we know. But unfortunately, there are some bad Muslims out there from time to time. And as a Muslim news platform and a Muslim journalist, we have an obligation to be truthful and honest and, you know, speak about wrongdoing wherever we find it, whether it's in our community or outside of it.
But do you find your position as a revert Muslim journalist, as a white Muslim, in fact, gives you a greater access to certain other news agencies or news, or is it a problem, or does it make a difference at all to your working life, I guess is what I'm trying to say?
I think it does make a difference. I mean, for example, I could show up at a St. George's Day rally in central London and be quite warmly received. And people are also a little bit more honest with me at those protests than if they would be, if, say, for example, my colleague Dilly or Roshan was to show up. So I do get actually quite a bit of extra access in that sense, especially in this country, because white British nationalists, as long as they don't know who I am to begin with, they'll welcome me in and speak to me quite normally. And naturally, so I'll get a unique, honest view potentially from them, where if someone wearing a sister wearing a hijab, for example, was to approach them and ask the same questions, they wouldn't have the same conversation at all. So in some ways, being a white British person as well as a Muslim, I do get a lot of extra access and a greater ability to work in this country, because Muslims will talk to me favorably, but also non-Muslims might feel more comfortable to talk to me as well, even if they're expressing views that aren't particularly very nice or very good.
It's a good example of white privilege, of course, isn't it, that you
it's
have.
It's about privilege. But yeah. I think the negative side of that is, although I am a Muslim and Islamophobia is a massive problem in this country, I can never say that I've experienced it in the same way as other black and brown Muslims have, because I just don't. It's as simple as that. I mean, people call me a race traitor online, and I get the occasional death threat because of the work I do. But, you know, no one's ever, you know, racially abused me on the underground because, you know, I look Muslim, or, you know, I've never had anyone like pour beer over my head because I'm wearing a hijab, for example, which is what our sisters have to go through. So I've never really had the same experiences that born and bred black and brown Muslims have had in this country. And therefore, I don't have a certain experience that I'm able to talk about in the same way. Obviously, I hear it from a lot of our brothers and sisters, but it's not the same unless you've actually lived through it and experienced it. It's not the same. So on that area.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm actually quite weak because I just haven't had those life experiences, but it provides strength in other areas where I can perhaps, you know, expose certain viewpoints from the other side quite easier than my other colleagues can.
Fascinating. Very interesting. So you mentioned that you can go to a St. George Day event or rally. You can enter into the company where white nationalists are hanging around and they're going to welcome you. So what happens when you make it known that you're working for Five Pillars or that you're a Muslim? What is there a big dramatic change of response to you?
Basically, the longer I'm at Five Pillars, and I've only joined full-time properly in October, by the way, so fairly recent, but the longer I'm finding that I'm at Five Pillars, the more and more I'm getting recognized and people are starting to realize who I am now. So occasionally I do actually get spotted and identified. No major problems as of yet. Right. But obviously then it becomes difficult to work because then it's all about chasing me out of the protest or chasing me out of the gathering. I think Five Pillars has a lot of haters, but I think that in a way we're very proud of that, because if you look at the groups that despise Five Pillars and don't like us, It includes the likes of Tommy Robinson, includes the likes of Paul Golding, it includes the likes of the Hindutva, includes the likes of the pro-Israel Zionist movement, all the groups that are basically would be considered the enemies of Islam, quite frankly, and even the enemies of good and honest, decent
people in general.
Humanity basically don't like five pillars. Even the government doesn't particularly like five pillars.
I remember recently a senior government minister actually mentioned five pillars in the House of Commons, actually, but then didn't mention your organization outside of the House of Commons. It was kind of parliamentary privilege.
Well, what happened was Michael Gove was due to mention five pillars. We were leaked, the press in fact was leaked a copy of his speech on a new definition of extremism, and in that speech he listed a number of organizations that could fall foul of the new definition of extremism in this country. And five pillars was initially on the list. That's what we saw in the leak, so we were bracing for impact of what that could mean. But at the last minute, during his speech to Parliament, he actually withdrew the name and did not mention five pillars.
Why is that? Because I noticed that strange change. Why do they drop mention of five pillars?
Well, Roshan, the senior editor at Five Pillars, has a theory that it was probably because the fact that we are a legitimate British media organization, which is regulated by Impress, we're all accredited journalists, we're the real deal. Right. For him to brand a journalism platform, a legitimate, well-regulated journalism platform, as an extremist organization would firstly make him a hypocrite, because he claimed that he wasn't attacking free speech in this country with the extremism list. And with the case of Five Pillars, he literally, factually is.
Yeah.
Also, I think that he was probably advised, we think that he was probably advised that that would just be pushing it too much, and it would put you in... It would just put you in such a conundrum and a hypocritical nightmare that it just wouldn't make any sense. So we believe that due to advice he received, he basically ditched naming Five Pillars at the last minute. But ultimately, you know, we know that the government's been after Five Pillars for a long time. We're not the only organization here. There are many grassroots, fantastic Muslim organizations in this country that are unapologetic. They speak up for the community and they condemn British foreign policy. And they're not afraid of the consequences of speaking out and saying what they have to say. Mm-hmm. And the government, particularly this current Tory government, which engages in divisive, hateful political rhetoric all the time to further their own fan base, they're willing to throw any Muslim organization that they want under the bus for their own benefit. And, you know, we're happy with that. You know, that's the whole point of being here. If we weren't making an impact and, you know, rattling a few cages, particularly those in power doing all the wrong in the world that we see, we wouldn't be doing a very good job. So if anything, it's a badge of honor that we wear at Five Pillars quite proudly.
Now, you talk about rattling cages. I want to come to a bit of cage rattling that you yourself have done recently. And it's up on the Five Pillars Twitter feed now on your website. And I think you personally broke this story. It's about a sixth form college in Birmingham banning gender segregation in the Jummah prayers. These are Friday prayers that Muslims attend, and how this resulted in students being forced to pray outside. Now, why this is kind of cage rattling is because a lot of non-Muslim British people will find the idea in their minds, the idea of gender segregation, abhorrent, although they don't have a problem with it when it comes to perhaps changing rooms in swimming pools or in prisons or in all that sort of other contexts. But in their minds, they have a problem with it. But what's interesting about what you've done is that you're fearlessly promoting this cause, if you like, that this is normative Islamic practice in prayer, that men and women pray separately. And there's no discrimination involved. There's no superiority, inferiority. It's simply respecting the different genders. But you fearlessly promoted this as a news item in your news agency. Well, can you tell us a bit about that? And can you give us an update? Because this story is several days old now, isn't it? What's going on now?
So basically, yes, I think last Friday I went up to Solihull, which is near Birmingham, and there was a college there, a sixth form college, Solihull Sixth Form College, which has entered into a row with Muslim students there. You're absolutely right. So it's gender segregation that's the main issue here. What had apparently happened was there's a multi-faith prayer room which Muslims had been using. Now, as you know, Paul, the main religion in many schools and colleges and universities across the country is Islam. And Muslims pray five times a day, and every Friday they have congregational Jummah prayers. Now, when it comes to multi-faith rooms, of course, other faiths are allowed to go in there and use the facilities, but ultimately they never tend to do so.
Create the deck of your dreams now at Menards. Spend less time maintaining your deck and more time enjoying it. With UltraDeck low-maintenance composite decking from Menards. It's easy to install and built to last. Plus, get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on UltraDeck. And check out more great deals happening now at Menards. Save big money at
Menards. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Because
I've never seen any Christians hanging around in these multi-faith prayer rooms. We're going to see a Catholic priest holding mass. Never happens. It's always Muslims praying.
Absolutely. I've traveled the world. I've used airport multi-faith prayer rooms. I've used prayer rooms in all sorts of facilities, schools and everything, workplace environments, offices, buildings, and you never find anyone but Muslims in there. But anyway. So the Muslims were using the facilities as they had the right to do. No one else particularly was using them. And in order to segregate the genders during the khutbah and for prayers, they had basically erected some kind of a curtain, basically, to completely separate the room. Now, some educators at the college apparently had an issue with this. They confronted the Muslims about it, the students, and they said, you have to take it down. There was no compromise on the issue. Obviously, Muslims felt that without the curtain, they weren't able to pray and practice properly because the genders were not segregated. Mm-hmm. Leaked audio recordings of teacher-student interactions appeared to show at least one educator at the college being a bit hardline, quite uncompromising, basically claiming that the curtain was, you know, intimidating. I'm paraphrasing here. She basically said it was unwelcoming. It made people feel intimidated, and there was no wiggle room here. They were not going to allow the curtain, and they went a step further and basically said, "Look, we're not for segregation. We're not going to even support segregation in any form." The Muslim students were trying to say, "Well, what about if we use chairs and something like that?" And they were like, "No, no, no. You can use the prayer room as it is." Or not at all.
So presumably no sisters, no Muslim females were complaining that this was a non-Muslim teacher took it upon themselves to pontificate as a good kind of liberal about how Muslims practice their faith. That's quite controversial, isn't it?
Yeah, there were Muslim females present, students who I've witnessed, who are part of the outdoor protest, the prayer protest. Right. I didn't interview them just out of respect, but they were there. They were present. There were a number of them. So this is not a male-only led issue by any means. Right. And the fact of the matter is that the college appeared to start taking a secular identity on to these Muslims. So the according to the leaked audio, they were saying things like, "Look, this is a secular college. you know, this is potentially a bit extreme what you're doing, and, you know, we don't appreciate it, and if you don't like it, then there's nothing we could do. That type of language was being used. Once the students decided, look, we're going to pray outside, then this is an unwelcoming environment for Muslims, we can't pray here, you've made it impossible, you're forcing us to pray outside, basically.
And the weather in Birmingham is not famous for being nice and warm and sunny, is it? So that this could be quite a harsh thing, that in the cold or the rain, quite often in Birmingham. So the Muslim students decided to pray outside, and just demonstrating the strength of their faith, their conviction, their determination to continue to practice Islam, even in the inhospitable weather conditions they found themselves in.
Absolutely. Because, look, basically, at the end of the day, this is the latest example of a number of schools, colleges, universities, you name it, areas of education across the country, which are weighing into areas that they have no idea what they're talking about. You know, the college doesn't know about Islam. It doesn't know what gender segregation in Islam is all about. It doesn't know why it's done. If anything, they probably think that it's just an oppressive, backwards, barbaric measure taken by a medieval religion. Deep down, that might not be the college's position, but I'm sure many of the educators just assume that that would be the case, because, you know, the way that we are living in the West right now is that women should not only be mixing and mingling with men in every environment, including the bathroom now, but basically women shouldn't particularly be dressed. It's oppressive to be dressed. You know, do what you want.
Well, I mean, I'm going to push back a bit against what you say there, Robert. I mean, I read in the news recently, the government's now, this conservative government, obviously the end of its term, really, and nevertheless is putting forward legislation that new build colleges and places of work and so on, public institutions, must have male and female toilets, and they're not having any of these so-called universal toilets or gender-neutral toilets, whatever that means. So they are responding to this. So that's segregation, actually. Men and women are segregated. You can't go to anything else. So it's odd that, well, not perhaps so odd, but they get the message when it comes to these incredibly controversial things like having, you know, trans men going into women's toilets, whatever. But on this issue, they're not providing any support for Muslims who believe that men and women should pray separately, as their religion requires. And it's not a patriarchal or an oppressive measure at all. Women support it. Women support this.
Yes, absolutely. No, you are right. I think that some elements in government are starting to pick up on public outrage and the issues here. But I think we still have problems, don't we, where people are being tried for being, they commit a crime, like rape, for example, and then they go on and say, well, actually, I'm a woman and I want to be in a female prison system. And it causes all sorts of complications and the potential for female prisoners. So this issue is still ongoing. There's still a lot.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right.
You're absolutely right. That I think that most ordinary people are starting to complain about this. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that the West is still stuck in a very militant secular position. Mm. And it has a lot of ideologies circulating, which have become quite mainstream in some cases, like this idea of feminism, and there's a particular understanding of what's empowering for women. Mm-hmm. And Islam is at odds with that. And when they see Islam stepping up and taking a position like these students did, this is how we want to pray. This is how it's right for us to pray. Mm-hmm. And this is how we're doing it in this school, college environment. The educators just didn't like it. They were like, no, this is wrong. When actually it could have been very simply resolved. And I think there was an easy accommodation that could have been made, which made the students happy and the educators happy, but they just be interested in pursuing that.
And there is good practice existing. I mean, to the credit of the UK, and I think what one can say this without fear of contradiction, that there is an awful lot of good practice going on here compared to, say, Europe, in France and Germany. For example, a week or two ago, I attended Juma at the Oxford University prayer room. Now, this is actually in the Oxford University Department of Physics in Oxford. And if you look at the notice board outside, it's Oxford University Department of Physics and Muslim prayer room. And so you go into the Department of Physics and there's a special room set aside for Juma. And yes, it's segregated and everything is fine. and there's no problems. Everyone is happy. You know, it's not an issue. And you do see a lot of this in I've discovered in universities in the UK. You would never find that in a university anywhere in Germany or France, as I've been told by students there. So there are good things in the UK, but it's not. It's uneven, isn't it? It's kind of not universal. You get these solihull exceptions, or maybe not exceptions, where, you know, the Muslims are treated in a quite negative way. So there is good practice in the UK, I think that's what I'm trying to say. And so we can look to that and say, hey, Oxford University can do it. What's your problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are too many education buildings and institutions here which are, for some reason, they're being encouraged to take quite fanatic militant positions on secularism now, or in support of LGBT education or RSE education. And coincidentally, they often have majority Muslim student membership to these schools, for example. And so there's a conspiracy which is widely believed now that ultimately there's a campaign to target Muslim heavy areas with very strong ideological education institutions, and to basically take on Muslim kids and try and pull them away from the traditions of their parents, are harder to break.
Well, you would say it's a conspiracy. It's actually government policy. I'm not sure it's a conspiracy. I think they're quite open about it. They want to. They're not directly going to attack Islam explicitly. It's going to be, well, let's change their children's, let's change Muslim children's ideas. There is a more British way of doing it, through subtle change that way, rather than actually prosecuting people. Although that option is increasingly common as well, of course, for people who dissent from certain views. But just a couple of other things, if I may, about the stories you cover on Five Pillars. We've got these protests now. They started off in university campuses, the United States, in California and other places. They've now come to the UK and in Europe. I see in the Free University of Berlin, one of the most prestigious universities there, students, pro-Palestinian demonstrators setting up tents there. And I've seen footage just yesterday, in fact, live footage. It's amazing what you can see these days just as it happens, where the German police, you know, fully armed police, going in and quite brutally removing just students who are setting up tents or just camping outside the university, removing them, and the state accusing them of anti-Semitism and so on. And I mean, what? And there's no anti-Semitism there. They're just protesting about the genocide. But nevertheless, we're seeing protests at Oxford, Cambridge in the UK, UCL now. I've seen there are tents at University College London, in London. So it's spreading now. But there are these anti-Semitic allegations that the Times is making today. There's a big article there about this, as if it's all to do with anti-Semitism, when, of course, the motivation is a passionate concern for the genocide against the Palestinians. And I think you said that there's a fear of British Muslims waking up and mobilizing politically. You think perhaps that is behind this? There's this general anxiety about, oh my goodness me, the Muslims have got getting a political voice, and this is really not a good thing. They should just be a bit quieter and get on with their lives and allow other groups to be politically active, but not the Muslims. Could you perhaps explain a bit more why you think this is a concern that some people have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the establishment is very, very scared of the Muslim vote campaign in regards to the general election. In regards to universities as well, there is great concern because obviously that's the next generation. It's a mix of very different contrary ideologies to the establishment. So it's very anti-imperialist in university campuses. It's obviously very pro-Palestine, as we're seeing from the encampments and the protests that are springing up, and that represents the future. So obviously the establishment is very, very worried about all of these types of developments and protests, and it's trying to figure out how to deal with this, because these are grassroots movements with popular support that have reached the hearts and minds of many, many people. And I think when it comes to the student protests at universities, actually there's quite a lot of non-Muslim participation in those protests.
Right.
When it comes to, you know, the weekly demonstrations in London, for example, you can see there's quite a lot of Muslims participating in those protests. So it depends where you go. When it comes to universities, I'd actually say that I'm a bit disappointed with the lack of direct protests from many Islamic societies at universities in this country, actually. And I know that because Roshan, speaking to him about it, he remembers a time when he was younger, when Islamic societies used to be quite radical. They used to be quite active and very radical and willing to protest and make a fuss about things that they didn't like in regards to British foreign policy and how things were. Now you actually find that Islamic societies are not really that present at many of these protests. Some of their individual
members, have they been domesticated? Have they been effectively silenced because they want to just have a presence on the campus and they're worried about allegations of anti-Semitism or extremism? And I mean, there's a lot of pressures going on, aren't there, officially and unofficially, on Muslims in universities to behave in certain ways and to think in certain ways. So maybe this is just the result of this process, and they feel they've got to be unpolitical or they're going to get into trouble and lose their credentials maybe with the university. I don't know what, but do you think that's going on in the background?
Yeah, I do. I think that this is a consequence of Prevent that's been active for a very long time now. I think that Muslims are scared of speaking up too much, especially if you're part of an Islamic society. If you're a lefty Muslim in an anti-imperialist lefty congregation, then perhaps you might feel a bit more safe to kind of say what you have to say, although there are still risks for that environment too, of being accused of anti-Semitic and all that type of stuff, being excluded or expelled. But I think when it comes to Islamic society specifically, yeah, I think they're worried about being totally removed, totally banned, totally penalized, because, yeah, just being Islamic makes you more likely to be called a terrorist or an extremist or be, I don't know, referred to Prevent or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is, I think Muslims are scared of Prevent. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be as scared as they are, but I think that Prevent has become this sort of beast that kind of lurks in the shadows, and Muslims are very scared that they'll be caught out and then their whole lives could get ruined. And there are risks of that. Prevent is very dangerous and very damaging potentially, but there is organizations out there with fantastic legal advice teams that can fight back. So it's not as if we are totally defeated and exposed here. Muslims do need to be brave, especially when we face times like a genocide in Gaza. These are unprecedented and dangerous times, and extreme times call for extreme measures, and we shouldn't allow fear to hold us back. I think that's very un-Islamic. You know, Muslim oppression going on, injustice going on around the world. Yeah. We have to step up now, and that includes Islamic student societies. I'd hope to see an improvement there.
Okay. So, I mean, I've got a question that occurred to me. How do you balance the requirements of journalism to be objective and fair, as you said, about the news, and campaigning for Islam at the same time? Or do you not see a conflict?
I think there might have been a time where I did, but now, especially working for Five Pillars, being part of the Muslim community as I am now, very integrated and this is my community now, as well as being British. I'm very embedded in the Muslim community now and have been warmly received, alhamdulillah. But I think that what I've learned is that, you know, we can be politically active. We can do all of these other types of things, protest on a weekend. These are all effective means of furthering whatever we need to further, you know, getting what we want in this country using our legal democratic rights. But dawah is such an important power. It's a tool which I think is one of the most effective ways that we can ultimately achieve everything that we want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And now I'm of the opinion where actually dawah, I would say, is probably more effective and more important than even engaging in campaigns like the Muslim vote or going to protests on a weekend. That's where I'm at. Because
what do you mean by dawah? You mean sharing accurate information about Islam with the general public? And in that sense, you don't mean so what do you mean by dawah in this context?
I mean dawah in any and every form, sharing accurate information, speaking about Islam as part of your day-to-day, speaking about it as part of your work, going out and actually setting up stalls, going to Hyde Park. You know, I'm not saying that we're capable of doing all of that at once. I mean, I don't think I'd ever go to Hyde Park simply because I'm not very good in that kind of environment.
I think you'd be very good, actually. You're very clear and you're able to speak and articulate Islam.
True. I'm not educated enough, I think. I'm not well read enough to be able to have those heated debates that go viral all the time. But I think that there are people who should do that. There are people who should be Muslim journalism and talking about Islam in a journalism in news environment. There are people who should be setting up stalls as well as going to Hyde Park and everything else. There are people who should just be, you know, just talking about it to friends and family only. As long as we all engage in dawah in some capacity, I think if we're going to stay in the West as Muslims, we have an obligation to keep spreading Islam. If not, then the question should be, perhaps it's time to perform hijrah. I think that we have an obligation. This is where I'm at the moment. This is just a conclusion that I've reached through personal experience, including the experience I've gained through work and engaging in politics in this country, is that if Muslims are going to stay here, our priority shouldn't be to accumulate wealth, to accumulate homes and cars and savings. It should be to basically spread Islam first and foremost. That's the bottom line here.
That is supposed to be the case, yeah. So you mentioned the H word, hijra. I mean, the inevitable question is, hijra to where? Because it's not like, because although there are a lot of things wrong in Britain, it doesn't mean that the grass is green everywhere else, of course. There could be places even worse than here. And indeed, there are some places. So, I mean, if I was to put you on the spot, hijra to where would you say would be a possible destination for Muslims seeking refuge from the tribulations of life here?
It's a very difficult one to answer, and I'll be honest, I won't necessarily have all the answers, but I will tell you this, Paul. I spoke to a brother called Sam. He's a TikToker. His profile name is Sam in Somalia. Now, he has moved to Somalia, hence the name. And obviously, Somalia is not the place where you'd assume is a fantastic environment or a country to move to because of all of the problems in the news and the history and the conflict that the country's had, even terrorism, even extremism groups that have existed there and still do. But he's basically told me that actually he's gone there and it was the best decision he ever made.
Wow.
He lives in the capital. He says the capital is fine, it's stable, it's secure. The weather's fantastic. The food is even better. The people are charming and beautiful and amazing. And he said, as a Muslim convert himself, it was the best decision he ever made. And he's brought his expertise. He was born and lived in Cornwall originally.
Cornwall to Somalia. That's quite a change.
Yeah, I know. It's a funny, funny story. I hope to interview him one day when he's back.
I'd love to see that.
And bring that story to the public. But basically, he moved to Somalia and he said it was a beautiful decision. It's a beautiful country and it has its problems, but ultimately, you know, we're blessed in the sense that we've got a Western education which is highly valued. We have a lot of expertise here which many Muslim countries would appreciate, and we'd probably be treated quite well if we moved to some of these countries. I have the option of Yemen, for example, through marriage. Now obviously that's not ideal for everyone, because not everyone's going to be married and then can just swan off to another country in the Muslim world. That's not an option for everyone. But what I will say is that I think we have to break out of this desire to just live in a perfect environment full of opportunities all the time. We have to look to the Ummah and think of ways that we can empower the Ummah and make it better. And unfortunately, in parts of the Muslim world, there is a brain drain. But if there's a way that you can find a way to go back to the Muslim world and bring your expertise and your knowledge back to it, it's something that we should aim for. So I don't have the answer. I can't just say, well, let's all move to Pakistan. It's brilliant there, because Pakistan has a lot of issues as well. Mohammed Hijab found that out when he went and recommended the place, and everyone complained.
Oh, really?
He went and visited Pakistan. He said this could be a fantastic place to perform hijra.
Yeah.
I think he was in the capital, and he said the capital's fantastic and a beautiful place for people to move to. Yeah. But then there were actually many Pakistanis complaining, well, you're misrepresenting it, because actually the bureaucracy there is a nightmare. Right. If you want to set up a business in Pakistan, it's basically no go. And there are a lot of economic problems there. But I think what we have to do is try to explore that possibility at the very least, because people will find something, I think. Not everyone straight away, but if we explore the concept of Hijra, I think people just shrug it off and say, well, it'll never work. Well, give it a try first.
I mean, I would be very surprised, but I'm very blessed and fortunate to be able to travel in the last couple of years. And I've been to some Muslim majority countries, and I was shocked. I don't mean in a bad way, in a good way. We think we live, you and I live in the so-called first world. And I've been to places like Doha, and they're not first world. They're first world plus. They're actually more advanced than us in many ways. And I was just stunned. I couldn't believe what I think. Why don't we know about this in the West? And then I was told Doha, it's in Qatar, obviously, is not unique. And there are other places and so on. And many of these places are extraordinarily advanced, whether it be in terms of medical technology or civic infrastructure, transportation, the quality of life, the food, the weather, etc. Now, these places do have problems. I'm not in any way whitewashing them at all, but they are pretty obviously desirable places to live. And I know not everyone can move there. I've got a friend of mine who's a British guy, moving there very shortly, but he's a doctor and he's been treated very well. But, you know, he'll have a very, very nice life there indeed, as a British person, expat living there. So we can talk about Turkey, Istanbul, for example, famously, and there are problems there, of course. But there are actual places which are highly desirable to live in, Muslim majority places, but they have problems. I keep on repeating that, but I don't want to be accused of being naive. But, you know, you mentioned bureaucracy. There's bureaucracy in many Muslim countries too, but so maybe you're right. I think maybe we should keep our eyes open, and I'm not saying everyone, you know, if you don't have the resources to move, you know, it's fine talking about Hijra, but you can't do it. So it's a privilege. Only the privileged people arguably could even consider moving to places like Doha or Istanbul, for example, which does have quite a high tariff now if you want to kind of get set up residence there. It's not that easy or accessible financially. And that's deliberate on the government's part, because they're against immigration and so on. But no, maybe we should keep our eyes open a bit more and not be quite so pessimistic.
I would just say Hijra or Dawa or a bit of both. You know, that's how I think we should all aim to live. Because as you say, not everyone's going to be able to perform Hijra. No. Not now, not even in the future. But if that's the case, and Allah has decided that this is where you're going to stay with no means of moving back to the Muslim world, then I think Dawa, that means that your journey is Dawa, the Dawa movement, and just doing it in any capacity, even humbly in your own time, with own friends. We all have to engage in it, I think. I think it's such an important, powerful tool. That's why I think I annoy so many people online, because a white guy who's converted to Islam, who goes on Twitter and just says, look, I'm so happy. Alhamdulillah, I'm a Muslim, I'm British, and I'm so, so happy. It was the best decision. Islam, more Islam for Britain, more Islam for Britain. They hate it. They hate it so much.
They would, yeah, particularly a white British guy. Yes, I can see. But you get away with it, seemingly. And you can, because you're white British, you can meet them face to face and say, look, I know what I'm talking about here, you know. But also, I just wanted to just mention, I spoke to Dr. Abdullah Ali from Zaytuna College in California about this whole idea of Hijra. And he mentioned something very interesting. Even with people doing Hijra within the West, he mentions, you know, even in the United States, which is a vast continent, it's unbelievably huge, you know, that there are areas of the United States where you could do Hijra too, which are much more, perhaps in terms of conservative values or healthy family values and so on, but where there are welcoming communities. You don't have to just leave the US and go to somewhere else. And even within Europe, there are a number, I've met Muslims who have done Hijra from France to the UK, living in Birmingham. I kid you not, Salafi sisters, brothers, are just fed up with the hassle and the oppression they experience in France, the land of liberty and equality and fraternity, and they come here. And, you know, this is not a joke. They find a better quality of life as Muslims in Birmingham, for example. And I can understand that. It's not absurd. So there is this sort of internal Hijra within the Western political scene, which I kind of is also an option, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a very good point. And there are worse places to be than the UK, for sure. I mean, France is an example of that.
Yeah.
And there are other places in Europe where racism is a real problem. Like it's very in your face still. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that, yeah, in those circumstances, you may wish to move elsewhere, even if it's just in Europe.
Germany is awful now. It's very difficult. Yeah. I was just thinking Germany. We bash France all the time, and there are good reasons for criticizing the place. But it's actually not unique. Germany's just the same, actually. I don't know why it doesn't get the same publicity or criticism, but Germany's very, very authoritarian and rigid and won't tolerate any political dissent at all. I mean, and it's getting worse, actually, and it may be even worse than France, actually, now. And these are the twin pillars of the European Union, France and Germany. So it's no joke.
It's very scary. I mean, I've put it in this way previously. I'll put it in this way again. The Europeans seem to have some problem with committing a genocide every now and then. There's usually a little space, a couple of hundred years, but it's a recurring theme in Europe. And unfortunately, Jews have suffered from that tremendously. Other Christian minority groups have also been genocided from time to time. I fear a day where maybe the Muslims are going to be genocided, as we saw in Bosnia and the breakup of Yugoslavia. It's possible. Could Muslims end up being dehumanized to such an extent where they get marched off to some kind of camp? It's possible. When it comes to Europe, it's always possible. We've seen it so many times in European history. I hope it's not going to be the case, but sadly, there's a chance when it comes to Europe.
I think you're right. If Germany, which is a liberal democracy, believing in freedom and liberty, can actually provide political, diplomatic and military cover for a regime committing genocide as we speak, then anything's possible. We can't just say, well, of course, the German constitution, they believe in freedom. Well, excuse me, what are they actually doing? Judge them by their actions. And as you say, the history is there, obviously in Germany, notoriously, but not just in Germany, in other places too. I think you're right. Actually, there is a possibility. I got a friend of mine, a good Muslim friend of mine, who thinks it's very, very likely. And I'm not quite so pessimistic, but it's certainly a possibility. I think we should be aware of that, mindful, alert. We should always be informed about what's going on around us in the world, particularly in the West, just so we're not caught unawares, unlike, in the past. But we have to be alert to this.
I remember, Paul, just very quickly, during the height of the COVID pandemic, there was a serious issue with right-wing propaganda targeting Muslims during the pandemic, whipping up fear of Muslims by saying things like Muslims are spreading COVID on purpose in order to bring about the end of the world. There's some kind of desire by Muslims to bring about the end times, and COVID might be the way. So I think the one of the theories was that Muslims continue to congregate at mosques despite the ban on congregation in order to spread the virus. That was their objective, to gather in a space, get everyone like zombified on the virus, and then walk around like the living dead and spreading it to all the non-Muslims. And it was such a widely believed right-wing conspiracy theory that actually a government fact-checker website had to intervene and just clarify, this is total rubbish, and here's the proof.
In London, in Regent's Park Mosque, that was closed for ages. I mean, I don't remember mosques being open at all, actually, on the
contrary. Mosques mobilized. They mobilized to save people. Mosques were being used as food distribution centers. You could call your local mosque if you were stuck indoors and ask for help if you needed it, and someone would come round. If it was food, water, or anything else you needed, they would be there. Mosques were really important. They were blood donation centers, I think, or something along those lines. They would do anything they could. Mosques were the pillars of their communities during the pandemic. And many Muslim doctors and nurses were dying initially, I think, of the pandemic. There was a list of the number of nurses that were dying initially, the first few cases of death because of the exposure to COVID, and many of them were foreigners, frankly, many Muslim, many African. They were dying on the front lines trying to save lives during the pandemic. But still, these vile, nasty right-wing conspiracy theories, these racist Islamophobic theories came up, and they were so widely believed. People just adopted them and like, yes, that sounds about right. I believe that Muslims would do something like that, that the government actually had to intervene in order to try and quell some of that. If you think how easy that is for people to adopt that as fact, and then to perhaps go out and believe Muslims are trying to kill me, anything could happen. Literally, you could convince people easily that Muslims are evil and deserve to die. I believe that that's possible to do that in the right circumstance, in the right environment.
Yeah, no, indeed. Sobering thought. I guess my last question to you would be concerning your work in Five Pillars and the future of Five Pillars. Where do you and your organization see yourselves in 5 years, 10 years time? Do you think big? Do you have this vision thing? We want Five Pillars to be doing this in the future, in the long term, I mean. Do you have that kind of vision thing, aspiring to a certain goal?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you look at where Five Pillars was 5-10 years ago, before my time, when Roshan and Dilly first were sort of created Five Pillars and were working on it, they've come so far. They've come so far. I mean, this year you attended our first major iftar fundraising event during Ramadan. A beautiful event, the first of its kind. Can you imagine? Around for so many years, and we've never done an event like that before, a fundraising iftar event where we brought all the major faces and personalities from the Muslim community into one building, one room, in order to network and to, you know, promote Five Pillars a little bit as well. Yeah. And very, very well received. We did very well with that iftar. We're going to build on it. I joined because Five Pillars is inundated with stories all the time. And Roshan couldn't handle it all, so he's brought me in to try and help fight the tide, but we're still inundated. So our ambition is to keep growing, keep providing the service which clearly the Muslim community needs. That's why we've got so many stories. And I think the fact is that during crisis, people do start to realize how important the work Five Pillars is. That's the sad reality. It takes a crisis for people to realize, oh, actually, Five Pillars, if we didn't have them, then we'd actually, like, who else is going to talk about these issues, platform us in an unapologetic, brave fashion the Five Pillars does? We don't really have a proper competitor, if you think about it. There are a few Islamic Dawah organizations which, you know, share beautiful hadiths and stuff like that. There are Muslim news websites which share news from time to time. It's normally copy and paste, but they do have their little good bits, and there are some Islamic channels too. But Five Pillars is unique. I think wherever I've gone in this country and hung out with Muslims, everyone has always said Five Pillars is brilliant, and we all watch and love Five Pillars, but we just do not get the financial support we deserve, and that's because we're not state-backed. We don't want to compromise on our editorial freedom to say what needs to be said by taking a paycheck from a big government, which means we'd have to hush and fall in line from whoever. So, you know, Five Pillars, I think we're starting to get a lot more support now. People realize we need support, but we also have an obligation to step up and to keep growing. And we have ideas in the framework. I won't go into too much detail. We're going to expand our online presence. We're going to potentially, you know, expand the team even. We've got correspondents abroad now, like freelancers. We've got someone in India who's for oppression. I think there's a general election in India coming up where already Narendra Modi is engaging in some horrid sectarian rhetoric, which is probably going to pump out more in the lead up to that election. So a lot of big stories coming from across the globe now. You know, the sky's the limit for Five Pillars. Just keep praying for us, inshallah, because as we've discussed, a day could come where we are silenced. We could be taken off social media, gagged. We could have the government come after us, go after our bank accounts. We don't know. We don't know. That's the environment that we live in. So just think for a second, anyone who's watching, if Five Pillars were to disappear tomorrow, where would you be left then? Who's going to speak up for all of the issues that are so important to you? No one else does. The BBC's not going to care about Solihull or, I mean, they're demonizing the Palestine protests. They're platforming radical Zionist propaganda. You know, so Five Pillars is desperately needed. Support us while you can. Support us while we're here. And inshallah, we'll continue to grow and provide more.
Inshallah. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll put a link to the channel, the website, and the Twitter or X feed as well below. So do sign up, subscribe, follow. And as Robert says, do support them whatever way you can. A unique resource, a unique platform. for not just the British people, I think for anyone who's concerned in the English language to understand what's going on in the world. So do engage and support with Five Pillars, folks. Thank you very much indeed, Robert Carter. I won't keep you any longer. I know you're a very busy man, of course. Mm-hmm. Got news stories to chase, and I wish you well. And thank you very much indeed for coming on the show, Blogging Theology. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thanks for having me on.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.